My name is Beth Stelson. Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me with this? Okay, my throat's a little scratchy this morning. So today I'm going to be talking about the community reentry experiences of mothers who've been released from jail in Philadelphia, and specifically the barriers that they experienced coming out of jail and the suggestions that they provided from the qualitative study that we conducted. I have no relationships to disclose. So the incarceration of mothers is a growing public health problem. Women constitute actually the fastest growing incarcerated population, despite the fact they only comprise about 13% of inmates. In fact, the rate of incarceration has increased about 650% in the last 30 years. Among incarcerated women, the high prevalence rates of medical problems, behavioral health problems, trauma is exceedingly high. About 75% of incarcerated women have a behavioral health disorder. Between 85 and 90% are survivors of interpersonal violence, and about 60% have a chronic or communicable medical problem. And I think these problems are often conceived as incarceration health problems, but I would really argue that they're community health problems too, because about 95% of these women will be released back to their communities at some point in their life, usually with very few resources to manage these health problems. And this, coupled with the reentry stress, leads to a recidivism rate of about 40%. That is, about 40% of these women will be reincarcerated, usually within the first 3 years of their release. So I think it's frequently overlooked that the majority of incarcerated women are mothers of small children. And actually, the rate of incarceration of mothers has increased about 122% in the last 20 years. It's also important to note that about 1 in 25 incarcerated women are pregnant. And often they are separated from their newborns very soon after the birth if the mother is incarcerated. And this, of course, varies by locality and by state, but this is largely the practice. Researchers are beginning to investigate the maternal incarceration issues, and you know, they found substantial mother-child communication problems, visitation challenges while they're incarcerated, and these challenges also continue in the post-release period, which makes maternal-child reunification particularly difficult. We also know that the intergenerational cycle of incarceration is real. That is, if your parent is incarcerated, it dramatically increases the risk that you will be incarcerated at some point in your life. And this cycle is just wreaking havoc on many urban areas across this country. So thus far, I've really talked about incarceration in general. And when people are incarcerated, they're either sent to prisons or they're sent to jails. And while those terms are often used interchangeably, they actually refer to different systems. So prisons, I just realized the mouse is hanging out over the screen. I'm going to move that if you need that. So prisons are, they're operated by state and federal authorities. They tend to hold people who have been convicted of more serious crimes, usually for greater than 2 years. While jails are operated by localities, they hold people that are awaiting trial because they can't post bail or they've been sentenced for misdemeanors, usually for less than 2 years. And so due to the difference in funding streams, the duration of stays, prisons tend to be able to offer more programs and services than jails, though it's still very minimal. While jails are essentially operating as this revolving door of the correctional system and release about 12 times the number of individuals every year as compared to prisons. So thus far, researchers have almost exclusively focused on the maternal prison experience and really haven't looked at the jail experience. So we were left wondering, what are the biopsychosocial needs of mothers of young children who have been released from jail? And specifically, what do the mothers themselves say would have improved their reentry experience or would have improved it for other mothers coming out? Just as a quick note, in terms of biopsychosocial, I'm referring to the interaction of medical factors, psychological, social, environmental factors that all influence somebody's lived experience. So to answer this question, we partnered with the Maternity Care Coalition, which is a maternal child health organization in Philadelphia, which for the last 35 years, they've really sought to improve the health and well-being of families across the city. They operate the Mommobile at Riverside program, which is a parenting case management program housed within Riverside Correctional Facility, which is Philadelphia County's only women's jail. We decided to use a qualitative design to the study because qualitative methodologies are particularly adept at studying underexplored topics from a more phenomenological approach. So after approval from the University of Pennsylvania IRB and the Maternity Care Coalition Community Advisory Board, we conducted semi-structured interviews that was accompanied by a modified genogram activity, which is essentially a family mapping tool that we use to guide the interview process. We knew that in the course of these interviews, we were going to be uncovering a lot of sensitive information, and so we wanted to make sure that the guide was framed the best way possible. So we had it reviewed by the Maternity Care Coalition, jail case managers, methodological experts, and incarceration experts here in the city. So women who have recently been released from jail are a notoriously hard-to-reach population. They lack stable housing, their phones are always getting cut off, and so it's very difficult to reach them. So for this reason, we decided to recruit directly from the Maternity Care Coalition clients, current and former clients, who have received at least one unit of service, such as an hour-long parenting class while they were in jail. We devised a four-prong approach to recruitment. We worked directly with case managers who referred interested clients to be interviewed. We also then had a list of former clients, and we called 127 of them trying to recruit, and 94 actually of whom could not be reached for a variety of reasons. And we then made further attempts to reach these 94 individuals through publicly available data on Facebook, and we received IRB approval for that. And then we also worked directly with people that we had interviews to see if there'd be any family or friends that they could refer. And unfortunately, we couldn't recruit anybody through the last two methods, though it was a valiant effort. So all the interviews were either conducted at homes or coffee shops, wherever the participants felt that they would feel most comfortable. They lasted between 60 and 150 minutes, and all were audio recorded and transcribed verbatim. We then used Envivo 10 software to facilitate the analysis of the transcripts. As a study team, we worked to create a coding guide that kind of through an iterative process, and then we used constant comparative methods to code the transcripts consistently. 40% of the transcripts were double-coded, and we calculated intercoder reliability about 90%, 95% agreement. So we interviewed 15 women, and because we were recruited directly from a maternal child health organization, 11 of the participants were pregnant while they were at least in their last period of incarceration, though nobody was pregnant at the time of the interview. On average, they were 28 years old, had three kids, had been incarcerated in jail for about 5.5 months, and have been released for almost 9. So over the course of these interviews, and hold on, I'm just going to get caught up on my notes here as well. I was expecting the presenter here. So during these interviews, the issue of prenatal health care emerged very frequently. Many of the participants described feeling uncomfortable with the jail prenatal care services as well as interactions with the medical team. As you can see in this participant, she shared, "I think if they had the proper technology, so many girls wouldn't be sent out to hospitals because they couldn't find the heartbeat. They couldn't find certain things wrong because they didn't have the proper technology for it." Several of the participants also described how they really didn't think that the nutritional options that were offered in jail met what the women needed as pregnant women while they were incarcerated. This participant here shares how she felt that the jail staff expected her to supplement her food with expensive food from commissary, which was cost prohibitive for her. And then she goes on and links it to the low birth weight of the children of pregnant inmates after they were born. So In many of the interviews, participants described how they were exceedingly concerned about the prospect of going into labor while they were incarcerated. Participants shared that this fear was due to a variety of things, poor medical practices, as well as feeling that they would be handcuffed while they were going into labor, the correctional officers would be standing over them. This participant here shared how she actually refused medical care while she was incarcerated because she thought this would delay her labor and that this would allow her to potentially give birth outside of jail. The issue of forced separation came up very frequently in the course of the interviews, and that's the policy I mentioned earlier, where, at least in Pennsylvania, mothers and children have 36 hours after the birth before the mother is sent from the hospital back to jail and separated. So participants described how this not only created substantial anxiety and stress for them and influenced the bonding with their children, in some instances it also led the mothers to accept plea bargains for crimes they reportedly didn't commit so as to be able to give birth outside of jail. This participant here discusses how she accepted the deal and she recognizes it goes on her record, but frankly for her it was worth it because she wanted to retain custody of her child and she wanted her fiancé by her side when she gave birth. So several of the participants described how they believed the high levels of stress and anxiety that they experienced both while they were incarcerated but also after they released back to their communities, how this contributed to poor health outcomes of both the infant and the mother. This participant, the first one, attributed the stillbirth of her child to the stress of the incarcerated period. She said, "The doctors told me that my baby had been dead so long that the bones were overlapping. I feel like it was from stress because I was stressing out so bad from that because I had never been put in that situation." The second participant here attributed the preterm birth of her son to the stress while she was incarcerated. And the last participant here described how she felt that the stress of the reentry process had this bodily impact for her and actually decreased her milk production while she was breastfeeding. So during the course of the interviews, we asked participants to describe the first days, weeks, months after they had been released. And a number of the participants described how they went to the doctors to get their checkup, prenatal care, checkups for their kids. And a few moms, especially who did not have custody of their children, described how they were ineligible for Medicaid. And in Pennsylvania, we don't have Medicaid expansion, and so this was a barrier. But for a number of participants, they described accessing care actually with very few barriers at this point in time. And as you can see, it's kind of in this quote here where the participant is describing a need to go see her gynecologist. She's dealing with postpartum depression. But for her, this was actually very routine. So while participants didn't describe a number of barriers to accessing specifically medical care, they described a whole range of other barriers in the reentry process. As part of these interviews, we also asked participants directly what would have improved their reentry experience, what would they suggest, and we found that these suggestions align directly with the reentry barriers that emerge naturally from the transcripts. So through analysis of the transcripts, we identified 7 primary domains of community reentry: housing, education, employment, emotional social support, maternal child relationship, behavioral health, and basic material resources. And just in the interest of time, I'm going to discuss the first 5, but I'm happy to speak with anybody regarding the behavioral health and the basic material resources data that we have. And these, I'm not selecting these based upon any type of priority of them. So throughout the interviews, participants described substantial barriers to maintaining stable housing following their release. So often participants were reliant on family members, romantic partners for housing, especially as soon as immediately after their release. But these relationships were frequently unstable, and this led their housing situation to be rather tenuous. Participants also described how they tried to access housing programs in the city, but they were filled up, they were at capacity, and they couldn't access them in any timely way. In order to afford some type of housing, you usually need some type of type of income, and participants described a range of limitations to their economic opportunities that I'll dive into in a sec. A couple of participants also described either accessing the shelter system or fearing that they would need to do so soon, but they often described similarities then between the incarceration system and the shelter system, and as well as the fear that if they enter the shelter system, their families would be separated and split up. In terms of suggestions, this participant here describes how she does see that the lack of stable housing directly increases the risk of recidivism, and that if we could somehow offer more transitional housing, specifically for mothers coming out of jail, this would decrease the reasons why women would go back to drugs or prostitution, which she saw as the primary drivers of incarceration. Many of the participants that we interview discuss either wanting to go back to school or had already taken steps to do so, but they also described a range of barriers to furthering their education. They often describe how they struggle to balance the competing demands of work and childcare, behavioral health treatment, especially if it was court-ordered. Participants also describe how the welfare regulations in Pennsylvania, at least, only provided childcare subsidies if you were in school full-time or you were part-time school, part-time working, and if you had any other demands on your time, it made you really difficult to be eligible for the subsidy. Several participants also described the perceived ineligibility for federal student loans if you had a felony, or especially a drug felony, as well as how just with the unstable living arrangements, they often didn't have access to internet or just a quiet study space. So in terms of suggestions to target barriers around education, this participant was talking about the financial barriers that she really saw in terms of getting the GED certificate. So that there was a program where you could waive the fees associated with the GED if you achieved the certificate. This would eliminate that barrier, and then providing extra help to find financial aid. So as I mentioned earlier, participants experience a range of employment barriers. First and foremost, participants described hiring policies that really discriminate against any individual with a criminal record. And this, frankly, occurs in a city that technically has banned the box, makes it illegal to ask those questions in the initial stages of the hiring process. Participants then led that how this discrimination led to a level of personal discouragement in the job search. Many of the participants described how they reached out to community organizations that said they specialized in the job search and connecting people to jobs, but they said that these organizations frankly just helped with resume prep or interview prep and weren't actually that conduit to actually connect them to jobs that they needed. They described also how mental health problems made it very difficult to work, especially full-time. And once again, the issue of competing demands of childcare and school, searching for housing, made it difficult to search for jobs. In terms of suggestions, a couple participants particularly pointed to improving services and organizations that said that they were connecting people to jobs. I think it's interesting that this participant here says there's already a system in place that could potentially do this. It's probation and parole, but to her knowledge, her PO is not helping her with this, and she thinks that it should be changed. During these interviews, participants described how they actually experienced a substantial amount of emotional social support from the relationships with their children. And this kind of came in two primary ways. One is direct social support from the children. This often helped motivate them to receive substance use treatment, achieve their reentry goals, just generally help with the stress. They also acted as kind of a conduit by which the mothers then could reconnect with additional forms of social support that with other relationships that maybe have been strained. But when you're looking directly at the peer level of emotional support, participants described how this was pretty limited. They actually often distanced themselves from their peers because this was also often associated with their arrest or they were trying to get clean and their peers were still using. Participants also then described how they sometimes reached out to family members, but because of these strained relationships, this form of support was not always consistent. So in terms of how to support mothers more, provide emotional support in this period, a couple of participants described how they thought they would there should be greater opportunities to receive mentorship and peer support opportunities, and this really should be formalized, bringing people together that had gone through similar experiences. So as I just mentioned, the mothers that we interviewed described how they received substantial amount of support from the relationships with their children, but they also experienced a number of barriers to supporting this relationship, both while they were incarcerated and also post-release. So while they were incarcerated, participants described how the caregiver must provide the birth certificate for the child to visit. This was often difficult to coordinate. They also described how the jail had decreased its visitation hours to once every 2 weeks in the middle of a workday. They described how phone use was cost prohibitive, and of course the issue of forced separation emerged in the course of the interviews, as well as difficulty coordinating with child protective services, which was needed to keep up visitation. Coordination with child protective services emerged as a significant issue also in the post-release period, as well as lack of stable housing, which I mentioned earlier, which was often a requirement to regain custody. Family members were providing caregiving for their children, sometimes informally, and then also sometimes made it very difficult for the mothers to have contact with their kids illegally. The caregivers were doing this illegally. As well as they described how the general time while they were incarcerated, that time elapsed, created a feeling of separateness and distance with their kids, and they felt like they had to make up for lost time. So in terms of suggestions to support the maternal-child relationship, three participants kind of spoke directly to this, and this participant here described how she suggested, instead of locking women up because they can't afford bail, there might be ways that they could be put on house arrest and stay with their kids while they are awaiting trial. This participant here described how she felt she had been stripped of her parental rights with very little legal recourse, did not really understand the system, and that you could increase the number of services that could help women navigate issues surrounding their parental rights. This would help her overcome that barrier. Lastly, one participant spoke about how the reunification process is particularly challenging for families, and that if we could increase access to family counseling, this would help with the reunification process. See from this data, participants identified a definitive need to improve prenatal services within at least this jail facility, and you can begin to see how poor prenatal care services, along with child welfare policies, how they intersect and start to inform participants' decisions to either refuse medical care or, in some cases, also to accept plea bargains so that they could be released early and give birth outside of jail. Participants also, in the course of these interviews, described how they believe the jail environment and the reentry stress produce adverse maternal child health outcomes for themselves and their kids. And while I do not intend to minimize the standard of care, at least within this jail facility, or the outcomes for mothers and children, I do question whether targeting services around perinatal medical care is actually the most important barrier to women in the reentry period. When we ask participants directly about the difficulties in their reentry, about suggestions to improve it, they didn't actually speak about medical care. They were instead speaking to what we refer commonly to as the social determinants of health. They're talking about housing, they're talking about education, they're talking about social support. And we know that interventions are frequently most effective when they match the prioritization of their target population. And so if we're thinking about ways to stabilize mothers and children in the reentry process, I think we really should take into account the barriers that they're identifying and the suggestions that they're providing. I think it can be helpful to look at the participants' suggestions according to the ecological model. And as you can see here, participants particularly identified gaps at the organizational level, so services that didn't exist or they thought that were weak and that need to be strengthened. but you can also see that they identified suggestions along the spectrum of the model, that at the interpersonal level, that there are mentorship opportunities, that there should be reunification counseling. But then at the policy level, how can we look at our bail policies and figure out if there's a way that we could support mothers to be on house arrest instead? I think also by organizing suggestions according to the ecological model, it starts to just really illustrate just how complicated the reentry process is, and that if we are going to devise interventions to support mothers in this period, these interventions, they need to be multifaceted. They need to really reflect the range of the ecological determinants of their reentry process. So, as with any study, this study was subject to some limitations because we recruited directly from a maternal child health organization. The participants that participated in the study might have had higher levels of social support and resources that allowed them to complete an interview. We also had a small sample size, and we're in the process of actually expanding the study to better characterize what successful reentry looks like for moms coming out of jail. And I believe if we had gathered even more interviews, we would have been able to see even a wider range of experiences. That being said, I do believe that the information that we gathered in these transcripts, I think this information is transferable to other urban areas across the country. And I think if we're looking at ways to devise interventions, I think we really do need to look at the barriers and the suggestions that these mothers provided in the course of these interviews. So thank you.
You can make it.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I wanted to talk about that, but there's some time constraints on this. So actually, I have some slides for this. So when we list the seven primary domains of community reentry, I collapse recovery substance use along in with mental health into behavioral health. So that definitely emerged as a major theme in the data. And you can see here that we identified five primary contributors to mental health and behavioral health: childhood and adult trauma, kind of at more of a general level, arrest and incarceration experience, grief and loss, psychosocial stress in the reentry process, and then addiction and substance use, which they described as both a contributor to all of these problems and also the reason why they would continue to use and then relapse as well. So they described, yes, that it was very difficult to manage. I talked about the competing demands in terms of education and searching for a job and behavioral health, and especially going to court-mandated treatments such as FER, definitely made it difficult to do these other important parts of the reentry process. What I found particularly interesting, and we actually presented this in a poster yesterday, was that we analyzed these transcripts kind of when we were looking at it through a different lens, according to the four different types of social support, and that the relationship with their kids, they found incredible motivation in terms of appraisal support to really begin to target their substance use problems, that it was primarily through wanting to get connected with their kids, to set that example with the kids, not be sent to jail because they want to be there for their kids, that they would try to reconnect with recovery programs. This is Marjorie Mogul, who is the director of research at MCC, and please chime in with this as well. So,
yeah.
Actually, Margie, do you wanna take that question, actually, about continuing the study and your plans with Holly? Just jump in there too. So one of the reasons why I was really excited to work with the Maternity Care Coalition is it's not just a program that offers the services, it's taking more of a holistic approach to how do we improve the health and well-being of families. So there's a policy department, there's a research department, and so some of the conversations now is how do we use this information as well as the information that's going to be coming down the line to inform policies to really support these families in this time. And so I think we need, we need multifaceted interventions, we need multifaceted approach to create awareness and advocate for these changes.
Well, that was wonderful. Thank you very much. I love that you did qualitative research, and I hope you go on for your PhD very soon.
We all are encouraging that.